E-A-L.
Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
Good evening, and you're listening to Ask a Vegan. And I'm really excited this evening because I am broadcasting now from Real Worldwide Radio. I'm very new at this, and I'm realizing what's happening. I've got a bunch of different screens up here to monitor the music and monitor the sound and monitor any people that are potentially going to call in from Skype. So today is a celebration. Today is experimental because I'm learning as we go, but I've got a lot to talk about. What I wanted to say is I started broadcasting with Progressive Radio Network back in 2009, and I started with the It's All About Food show, and then we added the Ask a Vegan show, and I really enjoyed both of them, but the Ask a Vegan show has been really special because of the community that has been built around this show and the people that I've, quote, met online. I feel like some of these people are really close friends now. I really look forward to your comments, and I appreciate hearing things from you about the show and things that you've learned. So I've really enjoyed doing this show, and now it's especially exciting because we are now independently broadcasting this show, and I anticipate that this is the start. This is the beginning of the Responsible Eating and Net Living Worldwide Network. And it is worldwide because I've heard from people from Australia and Korea and in Europe and certainly around the United States. And that's the great thing about the internet. I'm so into technology. It has so many great advantages. It has disadvantages. But right now, I am blown away with all the things that we can do with technology. And I'm always trying to learn as much as I can because it's moving so fast and there's so many great things that we can do, like what we're doing right now. Now, just a few quick instructional comments. So there are a number of different ways to join in the conversation. And the two ways to do it is one is to send me an email at info@realmeals.org, and that will work during the program. It'll work during the week, info@realmeals.org. Now, if you want to call in, what you need to do is go to skype.com. If you don't have an account there, it's free. You can register, and once you've downloaded the application, it's not that complicated. It may sound complicated, and many of you are already involved with Skype, so you know what I'm talking about. But once you have the application open, you can search for Ask a Vegan, all one word, no spaces, Ask a Vegan, and that's me, and you can start a call. I'll accept it, and then you'll be on the show. So that's how you can call in. I've got my Skype application open. And so it would be great to hear from you. So that's how it works. So let's get started. Now, I love to talk about food, especially plant food, and all of the wonders behind plant food, and also some of the downsides of technology. Now, I said that I love technology, but sometimes we don't think through enough when we come up with something really brilliant. It's like kids that don't want to clean up after playing with their toys. We come up with something great, something fun, something innovative, but we leave a big mess. So let's which mess shall we talk about first? Okay. I had someone write in and ask about nutritional yeast, and whether or not I had heard that it was an excitotoxin. And nutritional yeast, it's something that a lot of vegans use because it's got flavor and it gives a cheesy feeling to things. And sometimes when you're transitioning from an animal-based diet, one of the things that you miss is cheese, and nutritional yeast comes to the rescue to some extent because it has this sort of cheesy flavor. And then you hear, oh, but maybe it's not healthy for me. And a lot of people have been promoting nutritional yeast, especially Red Star nutritional yeast, because it contains B12. And B12 is a very important nutrient that vegetarians and vegans need, and everyone needs. And as we get older, people need to supplement with it, whether they're on a vegetarian or a meat-based diet. And nutritional yeast has it. It's kind of a fun way to get it because it tastes so good. But the question is nutritional yeast healthy or not healthy? I'm going to go a long way around talking about this. Well, maybe I won't tell you what the bottom line is. Let's just talk about it. And I'm going to start by talking about monosodium glutamate, MSG. And I think most of us believe that monosodium glutamate is not healthy. It's funny because when I was reading about monosodium glutamate earlier and I put in MSG, Madison Square Garden came up, the big facility in New York City where we have all the great events. So MSG Madison Square Garden. It's also monosodium glutamate. And my personal relation with monosodium glutamate, I remember as a child, we used to eat out at several Chinese restaurants. And certainly we didn't eat out as often as people eat out today. Going out to eat was a special event. And many times it was either Chinese food or pizza or this local family-style restaurant. But when we went out for Chinese food, I would get this temple headache. I called it pressure. It was pressure in my temples. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't make it up. I didn't hear that people were having this problem. I just had it. And then we started to connect the dots, and I learned that other people had problems with Chinese food because it was believed because of monosodium glutamate. And then I learned that actually maybe I don't want to say that it wasn't real because it was real. I can still feel it. I can feel it in my memory. But there was an article in 1968 where a Chinese-American physician wrote a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine. And he had experienced physical problems after eating in Chinese restaurants in the United States, like numbness, palpitations, and weakness. And he wondered if it was the monosodium glutamate that was used by the cooks here, which at that time, he said, was rarely used by cooks in China. And he was wondering if this was to blame. And that might have caused people thinking that MSG was bad. And there have been a lot of tests that have gone on since that time. And it's really hard to say if there's been anything conclusive. There are some that say that MSG has problems, and there are some studies that show that there's nothing conclusive. But there's just lots of interesting things about MSG. Now, the thing is, it contains glutamate, and that's the key chemical component. That's what gives it its flavor. And the thing is, there are lots of foods that are found in nature that contain glutamate. Other things like shiitake mushrooms, a number of different seaweeds. These are strong flavored foods, and it's the glutamate that really gives it a lot of its flavor. And of course, there are some animal products too that have glutamate in it, and a bunch of vegetables like tomatoes. So the fact that it's not clear about glutamate and its component glutamic acid are these the things that are causing problems, headaches and other things? What I like to say, and it's true of nutritional yeast, it's true of MSG, it's true of the foods that contain glutamate. If it's a whole food or a minimally processed food, fruits and vegetables, I'm not concerned about the glutamate that is in tomatoes and other vegetables. But just like Jack LaLanne said, if man made it, don't eat it. I'm not going to say don't eat it, but you have to be concerned when something is man-made or synthetic. And so there are some that will say that glutamate is glutamate is glutamate, and I'm not so sure of that. When it's synthetic, it can't be the same. And I don't have to read studies to know what it does to me. And so if you're feeling certain symptoms, if you're having headaches or other things, sometimes you have to self-diagnose. Certainly, if it's something that's really serious, you should be going to a doctor and getting a full blood test and really trying to get to the bottom of something. But some of these things, doctors are really not going to help you with at all. And it could be just by doing elimination, getting on a very simple diet for a few days, a week, just some very simple fruits, vegetables, and seeing what happens, see what you feel, and then slowly add in foods and see how you respond. What was interesting to me when I read about MSG, and I'm trying to see in which of these 30 billion articles I have in front of me where it says it, but I read that there's a lot of glutamate in wheat. And I went, oh, maybe that's part of what gives people headaches when they eat wheat. Just a thought, just connecting the dots here. But there are a lot of natural foods that have glutamate and glutamic acid. And the bottom line is, when it comes to nutritional yeast, something that I really love, as long as you're not consuming more than a tablespoon or a little bit more a day, I think it's fine, personally. The thing is that glutamate, we use it. It's an amino acid. It's not an essential amino acid. It's an amino acid, and we use it for a lot of different things in the body. It is important. So it's not entirely a bad thing, it's just too much of it, or maybe from the wrong source, and it can give you a problem. Okay, so you're listening to the very first Ask a Vegan show that is being broadcast from Responsible Eating and Living. And thank you for joining me. I've got a number of different more topics I wanted to talk about today. Oh, more on glutamic. I got a lot of stuff here on glutamic acid. Okay, let's go to corn. Sweet corn. So corn's been in the news lately, and I don't know if people are really understanding what's going on between Monsanto and sweet corn. Monsanto recently got a new genetically modified corn product approved by the USDA. And there's a lot of people that are upset about it. But we really need to go back in history and understand what's going on to see if this is, or how big of an issue this is, okay? So, first of all, sweet corn. I love sweet corn. Nothing better than sweet corn grown on Long Island in the summer, fresh. And I also like to say, I mean, it's great when you boil it, steam it, and just serve it. And when it's organic and fresh, you don't need anything on it at all. But I like to say, do you know what raw corn tastes like? Tastes like corn. You can eat it raw, you can eat it cooked. It's just really lovely when it's a sweet and well-grown organic, preferably corn. But sweet corn accounts for a very small percentage of all the corn grown in the United States. About 355,000 of the 92 million corn acres grown in 2011 were used to grow sweet corn. That's a drop in the bucket. And most of the corn, most of the field corn, not the sweet corn, most of the field corn, most of those 92 million corn acres, goes to make animal feed, or it goes to make high fructose corn syrup or ethanol. And I would say most of it really is for animal feed. And then, so if we're going to talk about that very small amount, those 355,000 acres for sweet corn, 87% of that is for canning or freezing. And then the rest, 13% of those 355,000 acres, is sold fresh in retail food stores or farmers markets. Now, of that small amount, 10% of that is genetically modified, about 4,200 acres. And there's a very limited amount of that that's used for processing. The thing is, we've been growing genetically modified sweet corn. We've been growing genetically modified corn for more than 10 years for animal feed. It's been out there. It's been blowing its pollen around for a decade now. And some of us know that that corn has contaminated the natural corn to the point where Europeans who want organic corn will not buy American products because they're contaminated. And there are American companies that are getting their corn from Europe for organic products. That's good. That's not good. But the name we don't hear about is Syngenta. Syngenta is another biotech company, and their BT corn has been grown in the United States and Canada for more than 10 years. They have 8 varieties of BT corn, and it's grown all over the place. But they just grow to commercial growers, the big boys. And now Monsanto wants to get into the picture, and so their GM sweet corn was recently approved. So we have a nice little bit amount of competition. The thing about Monsanto's corn is not only is it genetically modified, but it's genetically modified with 3 different traits. So it is Roundup Ready herbicide tolerant. That means that you can pile on a lot of toxic glyphosate, which is Roundup Ready herbicide. And all the weeds around the corn ideally will die, but the corn will thrive because it's tolerant. It doesn't respond to this toxic chemical. And what we've learned over the years with Roundup Ready soy and Roundup Ready canola and other Roundup Ready products is that the weeds get smart and become resistant, and you have to add even more Roundup Ready herbicide, more toxins into the soil. So is that a good trait to have? Don't think so. But this new corn has 2 other traits, and that is that it is resistant to 2 insects. So there's a natural pesticide, 2 now, within the corn that will cause the insects to die, reject the corn, not want it. And remember, that stuff is going to go in you when you eat it. So in the old days, or the conventional farms where we're using herbicides and pesticides in the soil and the plant takes it up in the root and it gets inside the plant, mostly on the outside, but it gets in the plant. This particular GM sweet corn from Monsanto grows the pesticide within it. Now, this Roundup Ready glyphosate, or glyphosate, there's all kinds of environmental problems associated with it, like eliminating habitat for monarch butterflies, causing birth defects and malformations in animals, and lots of other problems. But here's the thing. This is what disturbs me about technology. I love technology, but we need to use it to solve problems and not make new ones. I have a quote here. It's a crude solution to problems that need to be addressed at the root cause, said Tom Stearns, president of Vermont-based High Mowing Seeds. Monsanto and Syngenta scientists should focus in a different direction. They try to outsmart nature, but if we work with nature, we wouldn't need technological solutions. The thing is that a lot of organic growers use a natural BT spray. So BT is a natural chemical that's grown in some plants and is used to naturally keep a balance of things. And using this natural spray is an effective biological pest control. But we don't need to create bugs that are going to be resistant to BT. And by adding huge concentrations in the corn, the bugs will become super pests that will be resistant to BT, and then the natural BT will be ineffective and will need something stronger and more powerful. And it's really sad because nature has given us a lot of tools, and if we could only work in harmony where our technology worked with nature, not against nature, gosh, it would be a beautiful, beautiful world. So what can we do? What can we do? Well, but the message is always the same. The message is eating fresh, locally grown, organic food and as much as possible. And buying from local farmers where we trust them, where we can see how they're growing things and know that they're not using anything harmful in the soil. But it's mostly with our dollar, so it comes to reading the labels and making sure there aren't corn products in the things that you're using, especially if it's not an organic product. Because these are the things that are supporting this industry. The interesting thing is that corn can be used for other things. And this is might be where the government and other corporations are going to say we need more genetically modified corn because, this is where it gets ironic, because corn can be used for environmentally sustainable products like biofuels and bioplastics. It's kind of a crazy thing. Now, ideally, here's what I would like to see. I would like, in Karen's world, I would like to see corn grown organically, no genetically modified corn. I would like to see factory farms gone, the animals grown in factory farms gone, and people eating a lot less meat, and we would be growing many, many less animals to feed people if people were eating a lot less of them. And then we would be growing so many less crops to feed the animals. We'd be growing less corn, we'd be growing less soy, etc. And then all of these fields would be available to grow corn, let's say, for bioplastics, maybe for biofuels. There'd be room for lots of things, for wildlife, for forests. It's a beautiful picture. Now, biofuel, there's lots of different kinds of biofuel, and I'm not saying that I'm a promoter of it because really I'm not. I don't think it's something worth investing in for the future because it's kind of a transition fuel. Until we really get into these sources of energy that are going to be non-polluting, because biofuel does pollute, even though it comes from plant sources such as wasted vegetable oil or from corn. So the ideal is to get the wind energy going, the sun, the solar energy going. Well, that's a whole other area. But we could be growing corn for bioplastic. We can be growing a number of different plants for bioplastics. And I've been reading a bit about bioplastics, really interesting stuff. And again, this is another great use of technology. But I hope it doesn't get out of hand, if you know what I mean. Bioplastics. Plastics. Another great technological invention, and everybody cringes and thinks that it's a horrible thing. But we have to think about how plastics have really changed our lives, and very often in very positive ways. We couldn't ship so many different things if it wasn't for lightweight plastic packaging. Plastics are in everything. And yeah, we have issues with plastics. We have issues where they affect our health, hormone imbalance, where some of these polymers leach into our food and in the air and in our skin. There are problems. But if we could create some products that had minimal or limited effects on us, this would be a beautiful thing. And bioplastics have a lot of potential. So they're a form of plastic derived from renewable biomass sources like vegetable fats and oils, cornstarch, pea starch, microbiota. And this is instead of using fossil fuel plastics, which are derived from petroleum. They're not all designed to be biodegradable, but some of them are. And they can be used, they're already being used for many, many things. The key is to make plastics that biodegrade and aren't harmful. And these starch-based bioplastics sound like they have a lot of potential. I don't know if you've seen any of them, but sometimes I've seen the packaging peanuts that are made from cornstarch, and you get them in a big box, and you can just wet them, and they just go down the drain. They just dissolve. That's lovely. There's so many different ones, and this is really the way to go. Because we can continually grow plants, but once we're out of petroleum, that's it. Now, the other thing is to be able to really recycle and reuse the plastics that are already out there, that are already being made, and the ones that are petroleum-based. And many people talk about how very difficult this is, how impossible it is, how energy-intensive it is. And I believe when we put our mind to something, we can do it. And sure, and you know, if there's a profit motive, we absolutely can do it. So there's a company that I've just been reading about, and they're giving me a lot of promise in this area. It's a company called MBA Polymers. After the founder Mike Biddle and Associates, MBA Polymers. And what they're doing is making recycling plastics from complex waste streams. And they're having great results, and they're doing great things. And I think they're making money doing it, too. And their processes require 20% of the energy needed to produce virgin material from petrochemicals. So that saves a lot of energy. Saves the production of greenhouse gas. That's amazing. And I hope to see a lot more of them and get some competitors in the business so that we can start cleaning up our act in a clean way and making money from it. There's another company called Greenopolis. And you can go, I think their website is greenopolis.com. It's a happy little place. What they're doing is they're putting out recycling kiosks wherever possible and making it trackable so people will get credit for the things that they recycle. And what they're trying to do is do this recycling thing on an individual consumer basis, not on a big industrial basis. So they're trying to make it convenient and fun and easy. And they have a cute little website. And this whole recycling, reusing, repurposing thing, it needs to happen in so many different ways on the individual level to the corporate level. And so it's great to see lots of different things happening. But I can't help. So I go to the Greenopolis website, and I'm reading, and I'm bouncing back and forth, thinking, oh, this is fun, this is great, this is nice. And then I was reviewing some of their blog posts, and I came across one that was 5 ways to green the cooking of your turkey. And I opened it up, and they talked about different ways to cook turkey that might take less energy or might be greener on the planet, and yet did they ever mention the greenest way to cook your turkey is not to cook it and have tofu instead? Why is that so hard? Why is that so hard for environmentalists to see or to know that consuming meat and dairy is so detrimental to the planet? Why is that so difficult? Tell me. Right. I was reading an article in Ode magazine. I like to keep up with magazines, but you know, sometimes the pile grows, and I reached in trying to make it smaller, and I was reading the September 2011 issue of Ode magazine, and I like this magazine. It's for the intelligent optimist. That's their tagline. And they bring a lot of stories that are going on around the world about people that are doing great things for the environment. But I can tell that they're a little schizophrenic at the magazine, or a little kind of on shaky ground, because here they are in the alternative land trying to grab the alternative market, the alternative health market, the environmentalists. And they're trying to keep everybody happy. And they're probably getting a lot of comments from all these nagging militant vegans. And at the same time, they're getting comments from a lot of people who are into the, quote, humane consumption of animal products. And they're trying to keep everybody happy. And I read articles very often that make me scream and laugh at the same time. So there was this one great article about how we need to rethink the way we think about food. I'm always saying this. They didn't say it in exactly those words. But it was a great article, and I'm cheering the whole way through until I came to this one whiny paragraph that mentioned that about vegans and how it was just a subjective, whiny kind of comment that, you know, maybe the vegan thing isn't the answer or won't be suitable. It wasn't based on anything. It was just like a little, it was whining. And this whole beautiful, sensible article kind of all just shattered. Why do we have those blinders on where we can see certain things and yet don't want to open it up to see the entire picture? But when we're talking about the environment, sure, using less water and using less energy and keeping the house cooler in the winter and warmer in the summer and driving our cars less and changing our light bulbs, all of those things are great, but we absolutely need to change the way we eat. And that means more fruits and vegetables, less animal products. We're starting to see it trickle into the message of the environmental organizations, but it's never fast enough for me. Okay, I'm talking about sugar. I talk about sugar quite often. It's in the news a lot. And this one, the National Health and Nutrition, is that the name of this? The National Center for Health Statistics. National Center for Health Statistics. I guess that's part of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Okay? They just put out a report, March 2012. You might Google it and find it online. The consumption of added sugar among U.S. children and adolescents 2005 to 2008. They have a number of key findings and a summary, which I'm going to review. And wait till you hear what they discovered, okay? Key findings. Non-Hispanic white children and adolescents consume a larger percent of their calories from added sugars than do Mexican-American children and adolescents. Okay, that's interesting. Did you know that? Would you have thought that? There was no difference in consumption of added sugars by income among children and adolescents. That's an interesting one. You know, many of us would think that those that are particularly challenged economically would not be eating as well, but apparently there's no difference in the consumption of added sugars. And more sugar calories came from foods rather than beverages. Sugar calories came from foods rather than beverages. I think it's around 40-something percent comes from sodas, according to the report. But the interesting thing is it's that secret amount of sugar that's in so many foods, some of them not so secret in the cookies, candies, cakes, and breads, but sugar is added to so many different things. It adds up, and the majority of food that children and adolescents are getting contains sugar. And let's see, more sugar calories, more added sugars calories were consumed at home rather than away from the home. Oh, more added sugars calories were consumed at home rather than away from home? Who's taking care of their kids here? So I think these findings are not groundbreaking, okay, but definitely interesting, and they may affect policy because, and maybe this isn't a good thing for low-income people because basically they're saying there's no difference in the consumption of added sugars by income. The bottom line is, we're consuming way too much sugar. Although the report says that the percentage of daily calories derived from added sugars declined between 1999-2000 and 2007-2008. So we have seen a decrease. I don't know how much of a decrease, and I don't know if I believe it. but there apparently has been a decrease. The point is, there's too much sugar around everywhere. This isn't about free choice. This is about being informed and choosing whole, minimally processed foods more often than not. And paying attention. And parents need to pay attention, because this report is saying more added sugars, calories were consumed at home rather than away from home. We need to care about our children. The sad thing is, when children are brought up with poor food habits, it becomes so much harder to break those habits as they grow up. We all know how challenging it is when we want to lose a few pounds or change our diet. And it's that much harder when you're raised as a child on a very unhealthy diet, or a diet that is full of sugar in everything. Now, you know, they talk about how most of the calories came from food rather than beverages, but it was something like 40% from beverages, 60% from food. That's not big. And the point is that a lot of the sugar, about 40-some-odd percent, is coming from sugar, which is likely soda and other sugary beverages. Just switching what we drink to water, teas, or just some water that's flavored with a squeeze of fruit juice or something would dramatically cut the amount of sugar we're intaking. Dramatically, dramatically. Marion Nessel. I've interviewed her on It's All About Food, and she's had a number of great books out, and she's got a new book out on, what's the title? I don't have it here, but it's about calories. And I guess it got enough attention that where she, in her most recent blog, she talked about how she got a letter from the Sugar Association that was threatening her. They weren't threatening her. She thought they might be threatening her. Actually, the letter was expressing concern about some misinformation on added sugar consumption. The Sugar Association is nervous, and they're concerned. And they're concerned when someone like Marion Nessel, who has a big presence in the food industry and is considered one of the food voices of reason, and when she's talking about sugar consumption and how significant it is in our diet, people pay attention, and the Sugar Association is paying attention, because that's going to affect their bottom dollar when people start consuming less sugar. But you know, if we were really thinking sensibly, if we were really thinking about, one, what's best for human health, two, what's best for the environment, three, what's best for the economy, these companies that are producing foods, the plant foods, that aren't healthy for us, that are manufactured into things that aren't good for us, could ultimately be growing healthy food. They could be growing plants that are going to be made into bioplastics, for example, or made into biofuels. We don't have to be consuming these things, and everybody can win in the process, but instead we're kind of stuck, and some of these companies are going to fight and fight and fight until the bitter end, and just make it so difficult. Okay, so here we are. You're listening to the first live broadcast of Ask a Vegan on Real Worldwide Radio. This is really, really exciting. I have so many great ideas and plans for this concept. Certainly, I'm hoping that we create a vegan network of different shows, audio shows, and then when we get a little bored with this routine. Not bored, but a little more confident and with the ease of all of this stuff, then we can go to video and create a full network of all kinds of programming and create a community of voices that want to make a difference for the planet. It's just a vision, and I know a lot of other people have similar visions, and I think together we can make this world a much better place. So let's see. Last few minutes, I just want to end on a sweet, sweet note. We have some holidays coming up. Purim and Passover and Easter and spring will be here soon. Woo-hoo! And that means great new recipes, great old recipes, new foods and seasons, and foods to celebrate. So one of my favorite recipes for a holiday coming up is the Jewish holiday of Purim. And I make a wonderful hamantaschen, which is a triangular cookie with a fruit filling. I usually use prune. And my version is not only vegan, but it's gluten-free. And I will be making these up and giving them around and enjoying one or two myself. And you can find this wonderful recipe on responsibleeatingandliving.com. Just go into your search bar. You could put in hamantaschen if you can figure out how to spell it. There are many ways to spell it, and I'm not going to tell you how to spell it here. You can more easily go to the lower left-hand side where the category listings are and click on gluten-free cookies, and you can find it there. That's the hamantaschen recipe. Okay. Well, you know what? I think this is a good time to finish off. And I've already found out via email that some people were not able to listen to this broadcast via iPhones, and I'm sorry about that, and I promise to play around this week and get things more technology friendly for everyone, because we need to have a big party here on Sunday nights. Okay, so what I'm going to do now before I end the program is I'm going to actually end the program with the real jingle. Have you heard it? It's something that I wrote with my partner Gary, the words. I hope you like the words. I hope you like the tune. And there we go. So have a great week, and thank you for tuning in. And here we go with the real jingle.
R-E-A-L.
Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
R-E-A-L.
Real's good for the planet, the inhabitants who need sound advice on the right thing to do
when it comes to good health.
We need facts that are true to choose what to eat and save the planet too. That's responsible eating and living.
You'll find the real tools for you.
Real.
Okay, thanks for listening. Have a great week.